I was talking Matthew chapter 6. We've already talked in chapter 5 at some length with regard to the truth concerning the conduct of God's people. Is that large enough to be seen around the room? Can't see it. Yeah, you have it already, but I still like, you know, I can read the same time before. I do all kinds of things. All sorts of things are possible in this world. This is one of them. That helps. That increases the size of someone. A dime, my whole fortune is about to escape. I've got so many things in the pockets of this coat I can hardly walk. But anyhow, it's no excuse for dropping money. But we talked in chapter 5 first about the truth of the Lord's people and our identity. And secondly, about the Lord's people and their conduct. And there we looked at the 5 antithetical sections and tried to emphasize that what's required of those who are the Lord's is a characteristic of life above and beyond what might be expected, I hate to say by the law, but just say it by the law and understand what we mean by that. So that there's required a characteristic of the Lord's people that they live on a principle or an agreement with the standard of Christ himself. And he prescribes that for them pretty heavily in 5 with regard to conduct. When we come to chapter 6, I see a slight turn. You do have to be careful in Bible study about inventing material divisions. But because of the nature of 5 with the antithetical sections, and then 6 moving into a straight lecture discourse, I think that's a legitimate division between 5 and 6. And I emphasize that in chapter 6 we're working with the concept of truth regarding spiritual maturity. You all have been here enough to know that you don't have to have my exact words and everything. And you might like a different section, but it really deals along those lines. I wanted to ask you, in a broad sense, without spending hours at it, but I wanted to ask you, if we have an understanding of what spiritual maturity is, not that we all agree every aspect, but we have some understanding of what maturity is and what's involved in it. I suppose the easiest way is to start by thinking of what the characteristics are of children. I'm not going to write them down, I'm just nervous with the chalk. But if you think about the characteristics of children, you'll think of 2 or 3 things right away. The ones I list in my notes are, first of all, you'll think of instability. They cannot determine a course and stick with it. I'm not saying it's normal in children. It's rare when a child does not have that. Instability, and they often can't determine a course and stick with it, so they fluctuate back and forth. And a lack of broad comprehension. The child can understand a particular thing. If you say, no, don't touch something, he or she can understand that, but may not be able to apply to something else. So instability and a lack of broad comprehension. And then the biggest single factor which marks almost every child I've ever known, an overwhelming selfishness. Not necessarily nasty about it, but an overwhelming selfishness in which they can hardly think of anything but themselves. It's mine. I want it. Give it to me. An overwhelming selfishness. Now there are some positive characteristics of children too, and some of those mature as you grow up. I've never made very much of the concept of trust. I've had lots of people tell me that children are very trusting. Some children are trusting and some children are not. It's very hard to generalize on that. And if you doubt me on that, try to pick up someone who's about 15 months old that wants his mother. You'll discover that trust is not wrapped in them. But there are some other good characteristics in children that mature as they grow up. One of those you'll remember is cited in 1 Corinthians 14. Where the apostle says, in malice be like children. Children forget quickly. That's a characteristic that as you grow up on and mature, so they don't carry grudges along with them. And you can think of a few other characteristics along those lines, too. They get over pains and problems quickly, on the whole. And when you get to be my age, you magnify the pain as much as you can to get maximum sympathy out of it. When you're a child, you don't get much sympathy. And so they quickly overcome those things. And yet throughout the framework of the New Testament, we are told repeatedly to grow. Remember how it's said in 2 Peter 3, growing is our repeated function
grow in the grace and knowledge of the Lord Jesus Christ. We're challenged to grow. And yet that's the one thing where you will find the greatest disappointment working with others, and they may find it with you. We often just don't grow. So the Lord says in this chapter of his disciples, as I understand it, he says, I want you to grow. I want you to mature. And that maturation will bring you to a point where you're serviceable and where you're patterned after me. I want you to mature. And looking at that concept of spiritual maturity, I've broken it down into two sections. That run through verses 1 through 18, and then 19 down at the end of the chapter, right on through to 34. Now, I'm trying to say that the first thrust in those things relates to spiritual maturity with regard to life areas and the way in which we practice and the way we live, and the second area with regard to the values we set in life and the things that are important to us. And that division may be a little arbitrary, so I wouldn't fight for it, but it breaks it down for me so that I can see it. And the concept is to have maturity in practice and then to have maturity in values. To act like an adult in our practices along certain lines. The Lord can't cover it, but along certain lines, to act like an adult. And then when it comes to values, have likewise values that are adult along certain key lines. That's how I see it, and that's how I've kind of enjoyed thinking about it. When I say that I've enjoyed thinking about it, that isn't always true, because there are parts in this section of the sermon, like in other parts, that are tough on me. One of them is doing your work secretly, doing your good works privately. And that has always been kind of tough, because if you do them privately, nobody comes up and says, good job. You know, nobody comes up and says, nothing. Always kind of tough. So I want to look at the verses 1 through 18 with you for a little while this afternoon, and maybe press ahead as we have opportunity or as the occasion's given to us. Mr. Garrish.
Would it be too early to jump down to what you have there to advise as far as spiritual maturity?
No.
Then, in a practical way of thinking, how do you discern if someone who really trusts in God to advise something for him with the guy who is insensitive to having not insensitive, but not insensitive, is so careless?
Yeah.
I'm not concerned. Now,
I think that's a good way to say it. I'm not sure I can answer that easily.
He's certainly not learning or doubting God.
That's right. On the other hand, he may not be trusting God. It's like a fellow who does, a fellow who takes chances with an automobile. I drive an awful lot every year. I'm keenly aware of the fact that I can't govern the other drivers, even myself. So I pray that God will help me to use good judgment when I drive, not to get too tired or stop. Now, I don't ask for miracles. I usually say a prayer. I say, Lord, I pray for help. And then I say, Lord, I trust you with the other drivers. So he comes across to me and fills me on weakness in God's will. So I think I can say that when I'm getting ready to drive, I really trust him. There's a difference between trust and being reckless. Being reckless would be going out in a mad dream and saying, I don't care if it's going on. In a superficial point of view, they might look very much the same. So you have to strip them back to motives and to what the product is. The child who is running down the street not looking for cars is not trusting God, but for practice. And if I want to do he knows, it has to be seen as a motive, the information, and what the desired outcome is. And there might be some times when it's pretty relevant.
So that's the bottom line. Because in driving a car, you can see that a person can evaluate himself as either being reckless, not careful to change the car.
They would admit it.
Right. But let's say, after school, you're looking for a job, and you're doing the work, you're sending resumes down, and you're printing it out, and you're really tired, and the work is well done, there you go. But after that, after you were very relaxed, not concerned.
Well, you know, it's hard to say. It's hard
and
to
other people
work
wonder why you're not.
I'd say that after that, after you've done that, and you're content, well, it's hard to find the right words to hear. But I'd say after that, you're content to say, I've done what the Lord has given me to do. I'm not going to sit here and stew about it. As opposed to a fellow who says, I'm not sending that here, isn't it? I'm not doing anything. I'm going to wait here. Ironically, he might get called first. That's incidental to the point, I think. I think there's a difference between trust of God, in which it says, I've done what I know the Lord wants me to do, and I will depend on Him for the outcome of these things, as opposed to somebody who says, well, what will be, so just let it go ahead. I think there's a difference. I think the difference in maturity has to be seen in motivation and application as well. Yeah, and you could probably say this last sentence better. That's the way I was thinking of it the day I prepared these notes. This is Mitchell. There's quite a difference between fatalism and trust, I think. Fatalism does not take into account intelligence or even your response or your commitment. Trust takes in all of those things. David trusts God, but he takes the stones from the creek. He doesn't just look at Goliath and say, you're going to fall down pretty soon, giant. He takes the stones from the creek. And trust, I think, always, like faith, mobilizes itself in the action of love and the action of obedience. Yeah, Mr. Siebel?
What about a person who seems so mature, yet the next day seems so immature, and another aspect where a person, say, is mature in many areas, but immature in some areas? How do we look at it?
Well, we look at we hope that we all have our weaknesses. And we hope that the person who learns maturity in many areas will grow in other ones too. We hope that if it comes to his or her attention that they're immature in an area, that they will pray and grow in that area too. But we all have areas where our maturity needs to grow, otherwise we wouldn't be told to grow. I'm fearful of those who look mature one day and are not the next day. I'm fearful because with my limited knowledge, I'm afraid that probably the truth is they're not mature on the day they look mature. See, I was raised on this farm in western Pennsylvania, where all you did was work. It was a happy life, praise God. It was not a Christian home, but it was a happy life. We worked, and I loved to work then, and I love to work now. I came home from school every day, and I worked. I worked in the barn, I worked in the chicken house, and so I enjoyed it. There might have been one day in my life I resented it, but mostly I enjoyed it. And when I was a senior in high school, I was saved. But I loved to work. And I came home and worked steady. I was as dependable, I think, as you could be. I never went anywhere, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that most people in the community thought of me as being mature. But the truth is, I wasn't mature at all. I was just in a situation where there were no alternatives but to look that way. So when I went to college, after I was saved, I went berserk in college. Now, it was a Christian college, so the kind of berserkness you can go is somewhat limited. But I did. We had popcorn in my room every night. And I stopped studying. I was always able to get pretty good grades with minimal effort. I'm not the top student, but I quit studying. I quit reading. I just became a social lion. So I was very immature in college. When they asked me not to come back, they suggested I should lay out a few years. Popcorn did it in, but there were a lot worse things than popcorn, but nothing like liquor and that sort of stuff. But when they suggested that I would do well to take a while off, someone said that Tom is such a mature person, but I wasn't mature at all. I was just caught on the farm in a situation that made me look mature. I'd never had any opportunity to grow. And I think by the time I was 30 and married, I matured a little bit. There are some areas where I still need a lot of help. So when someone looks very mature today and tomorrow looks immature, the suspicion is they're probably not mature on the day they look it. But here again, we will not be censorious or judge everybody's lives. Look at the text in chapter 6. Look at the text. You can read it in Greek or English or Mandarin, whatever you prefer, whatever you prefer, Greek or English. Take heed that you do not your all. I'm reading the King James. I can work it out of the English too, but I mean out of Greek too. I was just enjoying it. You know what I've said to students in Greek, since I've never had anything for Greek and likely never will, I said the same thing to them that I said in Hebrew. Translate a passage and then read it over dozens of times. Just read it and read it so you can just enjoy it. You don't have to look and say, what is that verb? What is that verb? The Sermon on the Mount is one of those passages where I sometimes will flip here and there, but I enjoy reading it back and forth. So the Lord says, be careful. Cross that way. Be careful. That you don't do your acts of righteousness before men. Alms is the King James translation. Be careful that you don't do your righteousness to them before men. For the specific reason to be seen of them. That you do not do it in the front of men. Cross for the appearance to them. and that's why you're doing it. He said, it isn't just that they see you accidentally, but be careful that you don't do your alms before men for the specific reason of being seen of them. The articulate infinitive makes that pretty emphatic in that particular place. Kind of thing. And otherwise, he says, you have no reward of your Father, which is in heaven. I've listed that as kind of an introductory verse, and the Lord then goes on verses 2 through 4 and talks about deeds of mercy, and in 5 through 15 about words of prayer, and in 16 through 18 what I refer to as spiritual acts. But the emphasis is that you have to learn in this life of spiritual maturity not to want the praise of men for the sake of the praise of men. You'll have to understand that Jesus is not saying, I don't think at all, that everything you do has to be done secretly. But nothing you do can be done just for the purpose of being seen. Just for the purpose of being seen. Because there's no reward in that as far as the Father in heaven is concerned. And I've always been kind of struck by that. So when you come to deeds of mercy in verse 2, when you come to deeds of mercy, on my chart, I suggest there's no publicity, there's no announcement of them in verse 2. There's no hypocritical end in verse 2. There's no communication in verse 3. Your left hand doesn't know what your right hand is doing. And that, of course, is not a literal plus, I think. But there's not a situation where you put up a big sign and say, a godly person is about to do something good here. No one's going to do anything like that. But I've always promoted it along that line. And someone would say, well, who would have a trumpet sound in front of them when they do their alms? It might not be a trumpet at all. It might just be some kind of an announcement or some kind of a letter or some personal representation. But people often advertise their alms because they want to be thanked for it. And I think when anybody does something good for me, I ought to thank them.
This sounds like a kind of verbal
Well, I think it's a speech figure, no doubt. Whether it's a hyperbole or a synecdoche, not a synecdoche, a metonymy, I think it's a speech figure, no doubt. But the speech figure, when you boil it down, says, don't make a big scene before you do something good so that people reward you. Yeah, I'm sure it's a speech figure. And I'd say that a commentator who tried to press it literally would have missed the point. It'd be like saying, go tell that old fox when the Lord spoke of Herod. So I think surely. But whether you take it, what type of figure you can work on. I'm sure it's a speech figure. But the beautiful thing about speech figures is that they bring the language into our observable area of life. And the concept is you don't do it in a way that draws attention to yourself. Acts of mercy, Mr. Siebel. I don't know. I think you get into a fudgy line there. But see, here we have to be careful about being censorious. I think that a man may really want to do works for the glory of God, but I think he has to be careful about the context in which he sets them. If you get the empress thing in the presence of men, then it becomes difficult, I think. See, we can go to a lot of different extremes. I try to avoid that. Because sometimes you'll want to do a good work, and you've got to do it in the presence of men. There's nothing else you can do. So it becomes very much a motivational matter. But I press that to that degree, and also the fact that the term acts of mercy from Elimao is used in the particular case, acts that indicate the showing of goodness and the showing of non-charging of accounts and that sort of thing. There are all sorts of possibilities. Dr. Lee.
Most of the time, whenever we organize an aid, it is in mercy of the church. There's no way that you can do something to organize and advertise. And we think that the question is really, you must apply it only in our motivation, or we should apply in all our homes.
Here's what I think. Think is a big word. I think the more we can apply the general principle, the better we are. I think that. But if you decided as an act of mercy, for example, showing favor where it's not, if you decided to do that in painting somebody's house, for example, it would be hard to do it in a secretive way. So I think we'd have to evaluate it. I think the closer we can come to the ideal, the happier we are. The closer we come to letting God be the rewarder, the better we are. But you could go to extremes on situations like that, and I think that there are probably some people who have abstained from doing good that they ought to do just because they're afraid somebody would know about it, and then it would work against them. I think that's vital. See there? He certainly worked miracles. He certainly worked miracles to that end, I would say, yes, in order that his person might be known, God glorified thereby. Yes, I think you can do a lot of things with a good attitude, but why does the Lord favor it, do you suppose, in this passage? It's so hard to have a good attitude, I think. Mr. Dunlap. Many times. Many times. He does both. You know, he'll say to this one fellow, go back to the Gadarene maniac. He'll say, go back to your own people and show all, tell what the Lord has done for you. Other times he'll say, don't tell anybody. So the Lord seems to have a mastery of those situations. But you have to see that here, I think he's making a contrast, not for a life rule in everything you do, but between those who love the praise of men, do anything they can to get it, and those who are his, who should want the praise of God primarily. Mr. Hagee.
In verse 5:16.
Yes, I think that's quite honest in the whole gamut of the thing. So we wouldn't want to cloak our lives. We wouldn't want to put the light under a bushel. But you see what a fine, I like to say fine line. But you see what a narrow line that is. But the contrast in chapter 6, I think, is not because of between, not a contrast between all men in general, but a contrast between those who specifically do acts of mercy for the benefit of being seen. And if you're not doing it for the benefit of being seen, you're seen and doing it, but you're not doing it for the benefit, then you apparently are exempt from this. Yes. Yes. It's very difficult. I've said that four times. But it's like that kind of... See, tonight is the night of the student banquet, the seminary banquet. Who's coming, I don't know. But there was a time when I was a student and I was broke a lot. I had very little money. I had a wife and a family. Like a lot of you guys do. Very little money. I'm not rich today. But today I'm freer. So today I'm able to look around and today I'm often able to help someone go to the banquet. If I know that they have a need, I'm often able to. But there are a lot of different things you have to be careful of. So I don't walk up to students and say, can I give you money? Can I give you money? Because that becomes a poor... So I work through the student council and other bodies, and I say, I will provide so many dollars and so forth. But if I went out and saw them put a sign on the bulletin board saying, Taylor is provided, then I would feel I'd kind of lost my reward. Because I don't do it to be seen of men, but as soon as I know men are seeing it, I feel good. Too late to give any more out now, so I'm free with you all. But the tendency of people in the Lord's day and in our day is to love to be seen of men. So if that isn't your motive, good. Like, let your light shine. Do your good works so others will see it. But so that they will see it, and remember in 16, and they will glorify God. And that's what Mr. Siebold said a few moments ago. If the work is a good work that brings people to glorify God, then praise the Lord for it. But you have to weigh the acts of mercy like that. And what you have to remember is, as I stretch across his desk, is that the Father in secret sees and rewards. Whether people see and reward is not so terribly important. But the Father in secret sees and rewards. And the thrust, I've always kind of enjoyed the thrust of it. The Lord says, I tell you, verse 2, they have their reward. They've got it. And if you do things to be seen of men, then you have it. That's the way it goes. And they have it. So the concept is with deeds of mercy, make sure you do them for God and not for yourself. Mr. Hayes.
I don't see why we can't take it literally.
perfectly possible.
Yes, we just don't know, to be honest.
Yes, that's what I would say. I would say the evidence of people who did that, there may have been a lot of people, but I would say the evidence of people who did that is small, or none, somewhere in there, somewhere in that bracket. I'm not saying it couldn't have happened, but I would say that the force of it obviously goes beyond that, because there would be other people who might do things to be done of men in other ways. And so I'd say the Lord is precluding, and that's why I'd say it's a speech figure, that he's precluding any type of mechanical means to draw people's attention to himself. Yeah. Now someday we may learn a lot more about those things. And there may have been some people that actually did that in a very vigorous way. You kind of think that that would be limited by virtue of their position and size. But it seems obvious that the Lord is not talking to his followers as if they're rich people with big retinues, but poor people. So it seems obvious that the Lord's people might fall after the same patterns. And likewise, when the Lord speaks with regard to words of prayer, words of prayer. Verse 5, no publicity. They like to pray standing on the synagogues in the corners of the streets. Note that they may be seen of men. That, I think, probably is the key phrase, and we ought to keep that in mind. Here the verb is phano, phaneo, that they might appear unto men. That they might appear and men might see them. And that's why they do it. I don't object to praying in public. And I don't care how you pray in public. If the concept is to honor God, then I think you can do a lot of things. I've had friends who worried about getting thanks in a restaurant. They said, well, when you bowed your head to give thanks in a restaurant, you just kind of show off. I never felt that way. I've always felt that I give God when I'm sitting at home or here at the school or in the cafeteria. I bow my head and thank God. And if I'm eating out at Dutch Amos, I do the same thing. But by the same token, at home I say, let's all pray. And by the same token, when I'm in the restaurant, I don't stand up and say, let's all pray. If you're eating with me, I may look at you and wonder if you want to pray too. I think that's the thrust that you run into in a passage like this. I had an evangelistic friend who, when he thanked God for his food in the restaurant, took it as an opportunity to preach the gospel to the whole restaurant. And again, the Lord knows the heart, so you understand I'm not making a judgment. But he would stand up, and in a loud voice he would say, dear God, among all these heathen people that know not Jesus, he would say different things. But that, I mean, you could easily hear him a long ways off. And his prayer was really a kind of an evangelistic sermon in which he usually got around to the food after a while. And it wouldn't be my right to say right or wrong, but I'm always sometimes worried that the ostentation can be more important than what you're actually doing. But you see, I couldn't really say that of him or of you, if that's what you do, because that's kind of in your heart. But the Lord warns us about making a big scene that we might be seen. So that takes a good deal of personal judgment, I think. But I like to say that the thrust is, and no publicity. So you go into your closet and you pray. And here again, the closet is undoubtedly a speech figure, although certainly there can be a literal closet. But if you're riding on the bus downtown, you know, and you decide you'd like to pray for a little bit, I think the Lord is saying you do it privately. I don't see any problem with that. So you could have a literal closet, but I think, again, it's a speech figure indicating that you go into some private area of life or into some private place. My own feeling is that you can have a closet right in a classroom where there are 50 other people. You don't stand up and say, everybody shut up, I'm praying. You just sit where you are and you pray. I've recommended that for people who got tired in class. Pull out your prayer list and pray. You don't have to kneel with your chair. Just look at it. You start to snore after a while. We'll suspect your motives. Go ahead and do it. And again, the Lord says, the Father in secret, he sees, he knows, he answers. Vain repetitions in verse 7. Some people think that refers to the practice of the heathen of shouting and calling upon God many times. Other people get quite legalistic on it, and they say you shouldn't pray for the same thing twice in a row and that sort of thing. I play a lot with the word vain and try to say that vain, in this case, means empty. It means empty. It means they don't have any real feelings of things. the much speaking of them, they will be heard, and consequently they kind of babble. They kind of babble the much speaking of them. And in that sense, their prayers are kind of meaningless. But you pray quietly and privately, and God who sees in secret, knows, and answers, and in the concept of verse 8, knows what you have before you ask, and answers. So I've had people say, well, if he knows what I ask before I ask, then why should I ask? Well, there are two big points to that you must see immediately. The first one is that we're told to ask. And the second one is, I need to ask for my spiritual strengthening and for yours too. God knows those things, but we need to ask. We're told to ask. We're told repeatedly to ask. But in the asking, I verbalize and visualize the prayer. And I don't know how many times I've seen that in my own life, something that God had for me. It was a great blessing and a great reward. But I asked, and the asking verbalized it and visualized it in my mind and made the fulfillment of it real when the fulfillment of it was there. And that I'd like to tell you is a kind of a remarkable sort of thing. We don't get enough real testimonials to answer prayer because we don't pray specifically enough a lot of times. And I won't tell you any long stories on it this afternoon, but I think that's what the Lord is saying. So both in deeds of mercy and in prayers, the concept is to trust God. That's the aspect of maturity. I don't have to get my reward now. I don't have to get it now. I can trust God. And when you're out preaching, you'll discover a lot of humorous things that happen. I'll tell you one of them. You discover the humorous thing that you preach somewhere, and sometimes it's bound to happen. If you're a pastor in a church, it's a little different. But I mean, if you're itinerant, like I do a lot of, you'll preach somewhere sometime. I don't have any fee for my services. I'm happy to preach, and I'll preach anywhere and ask nothing. I have never asked, but a lot of places give you things. And I've had this happen a number of times where, after me, somebody will say, well, brother, it's really nice to have you here. Our secretary and our treasurer, Mr. Snow-and-so, isn't here today, but we will send a check to you. I don't ask for a check. I don't stand around saying, no, done. But they'll say it. They'll say, we'll send a check to you. We'll get it in the mail tomorrow. I would say at least every year, I preach one or two places where they say that, but the check never comes. Never comes. I don't depend on it for a living. And I just say, well, good. Might have got lost in the mail. That happens, you know. A lot of things happen.
Did you ever invite you back?
Yes, yes. Yeah. Oh, yes. And I go and don't say a word. I think that's always been the case. That's right. It wasn't intentionally defrauding. It was an oversight. Maybe somebody failed to mention the treasure. Once in a while, a check will get lost in the mail. A year later, somebody will write and say, dear brother, the check we sent you in May is not here at the bank. Are you keeping it or suing me or that? That happens once in a great while. But a lot of times it's an oversight. But I kind of think in a situation like that, see, I didn't go to do it for money. I don't turn down money either, but I didn't go to do it for money. And consequently, I don't feel like I can stand around and say, I have to look up and say, well, the Father knows what I have need of, and the Father kind of must know that I don't have need of. Is that a silly way to look at it? But that's kind of the way we've looked at it, and looked at it over many times. At the times I would say that that is the most grievous. The most grievous is when they have, for two or three nights in a row, taken up offerings as a love offering for our dear brother. That's when you have to be careful to grieve your spirit. When they've taken up three or four nights love offerings so that we can, whatever they do for our dear brother, and after the service the pastor says, when you don't hear from those guys, then if you're not careful you begin to feel a little spiteful. Have to watch yourself in situations like that. But I believe the Father knows, so I ask him for what he gives and receive it. And sometimes things come that you say they would have come anyway. But when I have prayed, the verbalization and visualization of the prayer is enormously rewarding to me. And it must be to you too. On the strength of that, the Lord gives us this famous prayer, which is called many different things. On the strength of that, this famous prayer. Unfortunately, I boil it down to a few steps. It's a study in itself. I still call it the Lord's Prayer, although the books like to call it the Disciples' Prayer, the Christian's Prayer, all sorts of things. You can solve that for yourself, I think. But it's found right in connection with these words of prayer. So the Lord says, first, you don't need any publicity, you don't need a lot of fuss, you don't need a lot of solicitation. What you do know, is have to do, rather, is to express a firm dependence on God. That's maturity, a firm dependence on God. And I've noted simply the concept of petitions in this prayer is well treated in the Catechism and the Confession. But I've noted simply the concepts in this prayer and the things that are given with it. The honoring of God's name, the desiring of God's will, the confession of dependence upon God's gift, the willingness to share God's love, and the dependence on God in the walk of everyday life, because He's all-powerful. Now, Dr. Benoit has a series of messages in the Lord's Prayer that he preached in chapel years ago that were very good. I like to preach on it once in a while myself, but I always see it in that simple line, the Lord saying, look, you're mature, you're my people, you're mature, so you can see that God's will is supreme, we honor His name, and then we move through it step by step. If you have any thoughts you want to share with us there, I'm wide open. But I see that as a very simple concept of trust that covers an awful lot of theology and begins on the right note of glorifying God and ends, as I think of it, on the right note of praising God for whom He is and for His power. And the Lord adds then to that verses 14 and 15, going back and picking up in verse 12. And the thrust of those verses seems to be clearly, you can see a parallel passage in Mark 11, but the thrust of those verses seems to be clearly that the if is on, if, it's not an A, but an if, and that it's when you forgive men the transgressions, paraphramata, the transgressions of them, your heavenly Father forgives you, the Father of you in heaven forgives you. Now, some people think that teaches a conditional forgiveness. I've tried to say that in the line of all the language that's been used in the sermon thus far, that the Lord is again giving us a kind of a figure in which we kind of read between the lines, and He says, it's as you forgive others that the reality of the Father's forgiveness is known to you. The reality of it in your daily walk. See, I don't think you have to, when you're converted, I don't think you have to promise God to forgive everybody. I believe in a fairly simple conversion. I believe it's a result of a godly life. But I believe in a fairly simple conversion. And I think when you say, I want to trust Jesus, and nobody has to come down beside you and say, this means you'll always forgive. This means I don't need to do that. I think we're converted, and we come into the family of God, not fully understanding an awful lot of things, but learning to understand those things as we show them to others. And I've tried to say that in John 13. I've tried to say that you learn to understand love as you show love, and mercy as you show mercy.
What did you say concerning the reality of Father's forgiveness?
I said the reality of Father's forgiveness, as I understand it. When you believe in Jesus, you're forgiven. But the knowledge of that reality in the walk day by day, the understanding, the feeling of that reality, rather depends on your willingness to share it with others. Not the fact that it's coming. But the truth is me, I'm reading between the lines. As long as I know that and you know that, we can be honest about it. But the truth of the understanding of the Father's forgiveness only comes as you are willing to forgive others. I'm always going to kind of talk about that. A lot of people live very hard and bitter lives, even believers. They can't forgive others for almost anything. And they live almost distant from God. If you know what I mean, I don't mean spatially, but empathetically, they live almost distant from God. And the problem is that they find it hard to forgive. I endured that in my own life, you know, so you may not have. I endured that in my own life because as a boy, I so very much resented my father. Oh boy, it's hard to tell you how I felt about him. And after I was converted, your feelings don't all, not, after I wasn't thinking about it, I was converted. After I was converted, I discovered months later that my feelings towards him were not a whole lot better. I just could hardly tell you. But after he was taken ill, he was ill for 6 years, so it wasn't like 2 days, but after he was taken ill, it was like a big lump in me. After he was taken ill, I went to see him before I went to the army. Spent a day with him at the hospital where he was. And in the process of that time, in the process of that time, I told him how I had felt. I'm sure he realized it, but I told him how I had felt, and I asked him to forgive me. And then he told me how he had felt and asked if I could forgive him. So, you know, it's just back and forth. So we sat there in the hospital crying like we were both dying at the same time. But I said again and again, can you forgive me? And he would say, oh, yes, can you forgive me? So it went back and forth. But when I left that day, I felt I understood the forgiveness of God in a way that I had never understood it before. The willingness to share makes the reality of what you've got more plain. Now, that's reading kind of into the text or between the lines. Mr. Hayes, you had a point. Mr. Siebel.
I look at this so much the first time.
Yes.
Anyone who is forgiven will forgive others. 1 John 3, anyone who has been loved of God will love others. So John is saying, anyone who does not love remains dead. So there's that working of God in the heart. So people can have problems with this way of forgiveness.
Yes, I think that's a nice parallel. Again, we don't make it a legalistic structure. We say, here is the circumstance that ought to be true empathetically, pathetically, out of the heart of those that are born again. Because they've been touched by God's forgiveness, they ought to touch. And yet they need the instruction because forgiving is very mature. It's not the natural way of life. And so forgiving needs some instruction. And the Lord, you know, it won't be many years longer till the Lord's, and one will say to the Lord, make my brother divide the inheritance with me, and that sort of thing. It's not long. They're quite human, too. And you'll remember that they will have a test with James and John, and they want to sit in his right hand and his left hand, and all the other disciples will miss that one because of it in about 2 years after this. But that circumstance will be there. Actually, you'll discover that the amount of time that the Lord puts on forgiving others is pretty pronounced. You'll remember Matthew 18, 7 times 7. As Martin Lloyd-Jones said in a sermon that I heard once, and he hints at it in the book, but Jones said, are we to believe that every godly man should carry in his inner breastcoat pocket a little notebook and list the times he's forgiven everyone else? Of course, everyone sat there and smiled. Certainly, he said, we are not to believe that on the 7 times 70. You know, so when you got up to 490, you could quit. He said, certainly we're not to believe that. And I have never quite forgotten the way in which he said it and the drollness of that particular thing. But you'll find the Lord talks a lot about it because the lack of forgiveness indicates a failure to appreciate God's forgiveness and makes us hard and bitter on one another. I've just seen it ruin some Christians' lives. So I think the Lord doesn't say it in a limp way, but a very emphatic way. So he covers 2 points there, gang, the deeds of mercy and the words of prayer. And the words of prayer are given to the Father quietly out of your heart. You can certainly pray out loud. See, I tend to run on the extreme side of things. But you can certainly pray out loud, but they're given to the Father privately and meaningfully, not so that you will be thought of as a great prayer. And the last of these is a matter of spiritual acts, in verses 16 through 18, fasting. It does seem in verse 16 that the Lord assumes his disciples will fast. He doesn't give us a lot of instructions on it, but it seems that he assumes they will fast. Because fasting is a means to deliver yourself from the normal pressures of life. I'm not very good at it myself. I've been on a couple of one-meal fasts. I think that's a mistake. I think if you go for 3 or 4 days, maybe it's better, but it's tougher. But I think it's presumed that they will fast. And so he says, when you do fast, see, the hypocrites are back again in verse 16. You don't be showy, and don't do it in order that you might just impress others. And verse 17, look your best, anoint your head, wash your face, so that when men look at you, they don't think you're fasting. And the same thing is true here that was true in the first sequence. The Father in secret sees and rewards. You'll notice a nice parallel development in those things, see? Deeds of mercy, prayer, the spiritual acts. The emphasis is always on the Father, as we are dependent upon Him and waiting to see what the Father will produce.
And the father doesn't have to see it openly. He sees the secret, and he acts and rewards. That's quite striking.
You tie your sorrow to the fasting and then going on tonight. Some people want to say that, therefore, the spirit of joy has come, Christ can raise, etc. Therefore, now is not a time for us to have a kind of suffering in the past.
I never want to tie it in with sorrow, unless you go back to the Day of Atonement for a sorrow for sin. I think there can be something said for that. But it seems to me you can't escape the concept of here. Fasting is almost concealed on purpose. And I think that I would kind of, we're never told much about fasting in the New Testament. I said a moment ago, it seems to be presumed the Lord's disciples will fast, but we don't have books, we don't have commands to say fast this day or fast that day. But I would think that the nature of what he's saying is that the fasting ought to be involved with proper sorrow, but that sorrow should not display itself in a way that other people say, or he's fasting. Meaning, he's really cold.
Well, what about the idea of sorrow is not going to be fasting, joy is not going to be fasting,
not at the moment. Yeah. Might just as well be honest with you there, not at the moment. Mr. Garrett.
Somewhat along the lines of what Joe said, speaking of fasting not as planned, but those who fast because they're so taken up with the work of the Lord, or whatever it is that they are doing,
that is somewhat different. But you know, most of those people who get that way, most of those people are so taken up that they're not likely to go to you and say, boy, I was so busy in the Lord's work today, I forgot to eat. They are not likely to say that.
You think about not fasting for your purpose, but sometimes you set days a week, every week, and you regularly fast. That day you even know what to do. Without any purpose of prayer, and just are hungry all day.
I think that's fine because fasting is actually good for you. Great comment. My doctor told me that. He looks emaciated. He looks like he might die in a day. He says fasting is actually good for you. And I wouldn't see any problem with that. Of course, if you feel wretched all the time, then maybe you better not fast. But I didn't see any problem with that. Again, as long as it doesn't become a cause of self-righteousness. I like for drinking coffee. You know, I used to drink 20 and 30 cups of coffee a day. For years. I did it for years. And as far as I know, if it ever hurt me, I didn't know it, but I got embarrassed by drinking too much. It's a favor to see your drink or quit. So, 9 years ago in October, in that year, so I just quit. I just quit it one day. I said to my wife, I'm not getting any more coffee, and that was it. I didn't feel any bad effects. I didn't feel any nervousness or anything else. But here's the funny thing, doctor. I soon began feeling attacks of self-righteousness. Someone would say, oh, you quit coffee. I said, yes. Oh, I said, I wish I could quit. I said, I could stop. I did it. So the self-righteous attacks, of course, coffee is not a moral matter. Anyone who drinks that much would drink too much, I would say. But I just quit. Then I began having self-righteous attacks, and they come with fasting, too. Well, some of you will say to a friend who has a particular problem, you'll say, well, when I had your problem, I fasted and prayed. That didn't affect you, but if you were like me, you would have a problem. I'm going to stop there.